Want to get to know the people who produce the food that you eat? This is the place. Step this way and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming. Hey everybody, and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming episode 14. I'm your host, Will Evans, and tonight I'm heading just a stone's throw west of here to Nantwich in Cheshire to talk to Phil Latham. Phil, how are you?
Yeah, I'm not bad, thanks, Will.
Good, good. I've been taking the top off silage sides, off a silage trailer today, ready for combining barley next week, and you'll be very pleased to know that I was extra careful due to your Lensleg farm safety campaign that you're running at the moment. So I had you in mind when I was up the ladder doing that. So,
well, it's good stuff. We have the statistics that came out this week should embarrass us all. Actually, it doesn't make good reading, does it?
Absolutely not. No. But more on that later. Let's find out a bit about your background first. Can you tell us a bit about your farm there, please, Phil?
Yeah, we're farming. We're lucky. We've got a 500-acre farm that we own, and we have a tenancy on Lord Chumley's estate, which is about 450 acres.
Yeah.
So we dairy farm there, and on the 500-acre farm, we used to have a dairy farm, and now we're diversifying into different avenues, mainly into commercial business lets and equestrian diversification.
Yeah,
which includes sort of livery facilities, haylage, that kind of thing.
Right. Okay. And has your family always been in the area? Latham's a Cheshire name.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
I think the family's been at least four generations in the same farm.
Yeah.
I guess with a son, there'll be five at least. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think the Lathams have been quite tribal in the area. There's lots of them.
Yeah, there is. Yeah. So, did you grow up? Were you always going to farm? Is that what you always wanted to do?
No, I was a passionate, I suppose, eco warrior type. When I was growing up, I was really into my doing the sort of amateur naturalist type stuff. My mum was a biology teacher.
Did you have dreadlocks? Did you have dreadlocks and things back then?
No, dreadlocks. no, which is good because the contrast would be quite quite incredible now, looking like a light bulb. So I was very much into animals and to an extent animal rights, I suppose. Mm-hmm. But I really wanted to be a sort of Greenpeace type, you know, throw yourself in front of a whaling ship, save a whale. That was going to be my destiny.
Right, okay.
Something went wrong.
Yeah. Okay, so how far did you get? Did you go to university and study that there? Or?
Yeah, so following my passions, I did a BSc in zoology at Reading University.
Okay.
And so I got that, graduated, and then went off doing a bit of travel, and then came back having made the decision to give it a go working at home.
Yeah. Okay.
And then did a dairy herd management course at Reese Heath Agricultural College.
Okay. Okay. So what prompted your decision? What changed your mind then? Why did you decide to come back to the farm?
I think all credit to my dad. He's a pretty smart cookie, or has been in the business world or business sense.
Yeah.
And he'd bought a farm when I was 13 over at Middlewich, and that got purchased when I was 18.
Okay.
By Poachins, and they were going to turn that primarily into a large Tesco distribution warehouse.
Oh, yeah.
So while I was off doing my travelling after the degree, that deal went through. Dad got his payout and said, right, what are we going to do? What am I going to invest in? Do you want to give it a go? And truth be told, I was picking pineapples in Australia and just ringing home to have a chat. And they cropped up in the conversation. He said, what do you want to do? And you think, do you want to come home, give it some thought? I said, oh, yeah, come on, let's give it a go. And no one rings a bell when you make these sort of life-changing
decisions.
That was it. So I came home and decided to get stuck in.
Yeah, okay. And the farm's changed. It's grown quite a lot since then, hasn't it, since you first came home?
Yeah, we when I first came home, we'd got 200 cows at home and 300 over at Brookhouse and 300 at Organsdale. Hmm. And then we expanded to our peak was 850 cows. And then for a variety of reasons, I guess 2004 or three, we decided that Organsdale would have a change of direction. And then we scaled back the cows. They've got rid of the cows. There became a young stock rearing unit, the granary, if you like, for the herd at Brookhouse, and Brookhouse herd expanded from 350 to 500. And that's, you know, I guess where we went. And then we've had a little bit of fluctuation since then when we got hit with TB, lost 89 cows in a year.
Yeah.
So that knocked the stuffing out of us, dropped us down to just about 400. And then I said to myself, right, well, we'll get out when we're clear. But that isn't actually what we did.
No.
So we reduced the herd size to 300. So that was a really good, sensible size for us. And then my consultant came along and said, you've got all this land and you've got a ridiculous low number of cows. You've got to put your cows back on. So we're back to where we were.
Okay. Okay. And you've also done quite a bit of consultancy, haven't you? Specifically on fertility management.
Yeah, when I came home, I suppose I brought my zoology, naturalist kind of ideas, and having done the dairy herd management course, I did everything by the book for 4 years. And we did metabolic profiles, we carefully rationed the cows, we did heat observation 5 times a day, we did mineral supplements, 5K miles per conception, I suppose. Really went hammer and tongs, put a lot of pressure on the vet. The vet was selling us more and more hormonal solutions, I suppose, to try and help with the fertility, as I saw it as the number one priority for us. We really just didn't get anywhere. We started with a conception rate of 42%. We ended with a conception rate of 43%, and it went up and it went down. We called that seasonality and all those things. It really, we weren't getting anywhere. Mm-hmm. And then we got introduced through BOCM Pools to a Dr. Dirk Zeyer, who was a pioneer in embryo technology and on the embryo transfer. And on the back of that, he was a cow obsessive, and he looked at the relationship, I suppose, between embryo quality and the what he would determine as the cyclicity of the cycling portion of the herd.
Yeah.
And when the cyclicity of the herds were that he was trying to do ET work with were good, then implantation success was very good. And he got really into the whole manipulation of diets to try and improve cyclicity. And okay. Having worked with him for a long time, we were flying him in once a month to do all our routine work, really putting the cow at the center of our, and the cow's well-being. You know, what's your index for success, for how well you're running your herd?
Yeah.
Well, ours, for most of my career now, has been, how well are the cows cycling? Because we perceive that to be a really good benchmark for the impact of our management on them. And it's amazing what you can find out and how rapid the impacts of nutritional changes can be on cyclicity.
Yeah.
And having had two herds and run that system for a long time, we could mirror changes in two, you know, reasonably sized herds and have a fair amount of fair amount of credibility with what we were seeing. Was actually down to the nutritional changes that we were making.
Yeah.
So we had a big change in fertility and a big change in farm welfare. We cut an awful lot of drug therapies out and concentrated on making sure that you are what you eat. It's the same for the cow, that we were trying to address the cow's compromise, if you like, through better nutrition. So I did a Nuffield scholarship in fertility and cow welfare in Australia, New Zealand and Holland, trying to look at, as a UK farmer, should you try and pursue a higher input, higher output strategy, and what's the welfare associated with that? And the same with the other end of the spectrum at the lower end. And what's the welfare associated with that? Because we've got our consumers on our doorstep, and it's not something that everybody has that level of scrutiny. So we have to be good with welfare. And so on the back of that, and being a Topsy chap, you know, I did quite a few talks, best part of 100 talks on fertility management around the country.
Mm.
And yeah, I really enjoyed it. It was good.
Yeah, so you got a lot out of the Nuffield Scholarship.
Oh, I think it's a tremendous experience. Yeah. I don't think you realise at the time just how much you're getting out of it. Mm. I think, you know, there's, I guess, confidence, the ability to set yourself up some serious meetings on the other side of the planet, as it was in my case, and to try and come back and do a perform, if you like, in front of the Nuffields to give her a report, and the confidence that gives you to do other things. And I think also the fact that you've had time away from your business, allowing the business to run without you, removes an awful lot of that arrogance that we all have as managers, that it's got to be me that does it, and it all fall apart, it's not me. And actual fact, that's a curse to have that philosophy, but an awful lot of us do.
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
It gives you the chance then to try and do other things.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. No, I can see that, because you're right. We all think that, don't we? The business will fall apart if we go away for a week. But it must give you quite a different point of view. Yeah. See, I mean, you seem to be very passionate about the industry as a whole, Phil. I mean, we all know that it's easy to just sort of put your head down, concentrate on your own business. But it seems like you're very keen on sharing knowledge and taking the whole industry forward. Is that fair to say?
I suppose in a way, yeah. I get a thrill, I suppose, out of trying to have an impact and trying to change things, if they're for the good. So I think it's we're victims of our own apathy, I think, in the industry to shake things up, to try, our appetite for change isn't very strong. And we do get our heads down. And I think, you know, when your margins are slim and you're working bloody hard and your nose is against the grindstone, it's hard to look up sometimes and see different ways of doing things. And hopefully, if I can have any influence over things, then we can question some of those things and maybe address some of the problems that we've got. And it's just trying to find ways, whether they're problems in technical performance on farm, or, you know, the search for profit, or the way we market milk. There's loads of stuff we can do. We tend not to do it, because as dairy farmers, I think our collaborative spirit is, you know, that gene has kind of escaped most of us. And I put my hands up, you know, when the dairy industry was fragmented because people decided that was a great thing to do for the industry. I wasn't one of the people who signed up with a co-op. That was probably a mistake. Although, given the fact that they weren't the milk board's infrastructure and marketing were separated and split, it probably wasn't a mistake in the circumstances. Had that fragmentation of the milk marketing board been done in a sort of wiser, more sensible way, we'd have had vertically integrated co-ops, our own products, and we could have achieved so much more. But that's not to say that we can't do anything now, and it's frustrating that we see so little appetite for farmers to work together to create the drive for change. We really still believe someone's going to come and sort it out for us.
If only
we just keep working hard. I love the idea that we can make it better and do more and take ownership of our own destiny a bit.
Yeah.
I wouldn't want to live as a victim of it.
No, absolutely. Well, I mean, I guess that's why, I mean, you're involved with several industry, you've got several industry roles, haven't you? I mean, you're county chairman, Cheshire County NFU chairman at the moment, and you're on the Northwest Dairy Board, the National Dairy Board, NFU TB strategy group member. You know, you're obviously someone who wants to get involved and make a difference.
Well, I think when you look at TB, the inexorable spread of TB for the last 25 years, it's easy for us to blame just wildlife, and it's not just wildlife. It's ridiculous to have that as a position. But if you accept that, you know, it's half and half, which is statistically probably where about the balance of blame lies, why have we not been able as an industry to lead the change that's needed in the farming industry? Why have we accepted this diabolical situation and this spread of disease? You know, why have the vets not been more vocal. You know, and it's all very well to say, oh, we once wrote a letter to Margaret Beckett, or we did write to, you know, David Miliband, or, you know, there, I think there's a couple of big vet letters that were written. But we haven't done enough. And, you know, again, we're waiting for someone else to solve the problem for us. And in the meantime, the tide of TB spreads. And it's, if you're unfortunate to be located near to an area, sooner or later, it'll be, you know, crushing over you. And that's just a ridiculous situation. And it was not inevitable that this was going to happen. This has been a conscious choice by everybody involved. And I think, you know, having had a big hit with TB, when we got hit with TB, we'd never had TB before in my history as farm manager, and I'd done it by that stage for 20 years. My dad had never had a case of TB while he was running the farm. My granddad had in the early 60s. So we'd had a 50-year break from TB, and there we are, on the test, having never bought a cow in for 16 years, getting 74 reactors in the first instance. Jeez. That for me was a shocker and a really gut-wrenching position to be in. But there's no need for people further up the country to endure that. If we change what we do, and we change the way we manage ourselves, and we change the way we manage the wildlife. You know, it's ridiculous to conserve a diseased population of badgers. It's ridiculous to trade in inconclusive reactors. Yeah, well, there's two aspects to it all, and we should be vocal. I think we shouldn't be waiting to be told. I think we should be deciding as an industry what a better future looks like, agreeing that and a path to it. I think your proximity to TB and the edge area and the sort of the way you sit, whether you've had TB and a sort of chronic history of TB or never had TB, totally changes your perspective on the what you want to happen. That's a sad thing, actually, because then you get people who get used to living with TB who are quite happy to carry on with the status quo, if truth be told. And that is that then becomes a problem for people who've never had TB, because where does the balance of, where does the right course, where is the right, the right path, if you like, to tread there? For me, we should be rolling TB back, and we should be as aggressive as we can be in what we can do in order to get it under control, because there isn't a great future for a livestock industry. If the whole country is endemic, if we carry on being signatories of the OIE, which is the international organization that controls TB rules, if we're signatories that we're going to try and reduce the level of anaerobes in the environment, because ultimately it's a serious pathogen for people, and that's why we control it. If society says, stuff it, we don't care anymore about controlling it because we can pasteurize milk, then I would see that as a massive defeat for everybody, for farms and for wildlife. It would be a ridiculous situation.
Do you think it's a lot of the problem is down to the two sides being so, like you said there, that it's sort of 50% blame both ways? Well, a lot of people in farming wouldn't agree with that. And then you've got the other side, the likes of Mr. Dyer and the Badger Trust, who your man Brian May, who absolutely will not even countenance that it's anything to do with badgers. Is it just a lack of understanding between the two parties, or lack of dialogue, or?
Well, I think it very much depends on the lens with which you, or the prism with which you view life. For me, the people who perceive it to be all evil farmers doing naughty things are looking through the kaleidoscope through the wrong end completely. And if you're chief executive of the Badger Trust, then I guess you want to pillory and polarize the debate because it encourages membership of your organization. And there's a different agenda than simply disease control. But the statistics are quite straightforward. To be fair to Brian May, I went to his TB symposium down at Imperial College in March. And there was Professor Crystal Donnelly, who is a professor of statistics, statistical epidemiology at Imperial College. And her analysis, she was one of the RBCT scientists, was that the lower robust estimate of the contribution for TB that you could blame on badgers through direct contact and indirect contact, because obviously there's an element of sowing the seeds of TB into a herd and onward progression. Is the lowest robust estimate is 38%. Now, the direct contact element of that's just 5.6%. But the upward range that she gave it was 100%. Her robust figure for the what she genuinely believes the contribution of badgers to be is 50%. And that was echoed by the second RBCT scientist who spoke there, who you never really hear that it's reported. But there was Rosie Woodruff, Professor Rosie Woodruff from Devon, saying exactly the same thing. They're on the same project. They agree the statistics are right. And the overall contribution of badgers is 50%. So I find it very frustrating that the mainstream press and the Guardian, BBC and all these other press guys were there. They didn't report that at all. And in fact, when when Professor Rosie Woodruff said the 50%, she then had to frame the argument, but it's mainly cattle, because then she wanted to, if you like, go straight to the direct contribution, because it fits with the narrative of a badger ecologist. And so I think we have to be very balanced. There are areas of the country where there is no infected wildlife, and so the contribution is nothing from wildlife. So if you go up to the low-risk area, the reason they got a lot of TB after foot and mouth was because they imported cattle from the southwest without pre-movement testing them in a rush to restock farms. And they got a lot of TB, but all that TB was eradicated through using the skin test. So, you know, if you like, daft farmer behavior, but it didn't sow persistent seeds of infection in the wildlife. It was caught, and the control mechanisms that we've got work. When we did the road traffic accident survey in Cheshire a couple of years ago, there were, I think, 102 badgers picked up, and one in four of those badgers tested positive. And that is 100 times worse than it was 20 years ago, when one in 400 tested positive. So we've got a growing badger disease problem. And in some areas of Cheshire, in one particular area, 5 out of 6 badgers were found to be positive. And if you look at where Steve Carter did his work on BCG trialing in badgers, I think it's around 900 badgers. I think it's 953, but it might be wrong. But of the original population of badgers in year one, when they looked at the prevalence of TB in that group, 53% of the badgers tested positive for TB around Woodchester Park. Now, that means in reality, nearly 70% have got TB because the test doesn't pick up all the infection. So in the face of that, the farmers down there, well, they're stuffed if they don't control in wildlife. It's, you know, it's no different, is it? And I tried to get this across to people, is that, you know, if you came onto my farm and said, well, Mr. Latham, how are you getting on? You go, oh, I've got a bit of a problem, actually. I've got a bit of an infection in my calf house. And you go, oh, what's the problem? I've got this sort of bacterial pneumonia thing going on. And we've got brown Swiss cows, but we've also got some Hereford in there as well. And you go, oh, what are you doing, Phil? What's the strategy? You say, well, when I've got infection in my brown Swiss calves, I treat it. Yeah, okay. And what do you do for the Hereford? Oh, no. We don't treat them. No, we leave them be. You go, and how's that strategy working out for you? Well, it's not very well. Everything keeps dying. You would look at me and go, Phil, this, I think I can see a better way of doing this. And actually, I don't think we're any different from that in the way we've addressed TB. For political and social reasons, we have the society, the government have chosen to ignore the wildlife problem. And that's absolutely insane. But at the same time, why are we trading in inconclusive reactors between farms and not telling people that they were inconclusive reactors? One in five inconclusive reactors will test positive. So if you've got a farm and you've had some inconclusive reactors, there's a one in five chance if you sell them that someone is going to go down with TB. Now, you could, if you've got reasonable integrity, you would say to yourself, well, I'll tell you what I'll do is I'll shove them in the down to the abattoir at a timing of my choice. But, you know, that's their destiny. But there's a risk to you if you do that, because if they have got TB, then you get shut up again. Or you could put them in the marketplace and go, I've got too many cows this week, fella. And you shove them in the marketplace and you close your eyes and you don't look at who's bought them. And you take the money. And you've de-risked your business, but you've potentially infected someone else's herd, and maybe they've never had TB. It's entirely selfish, and it is a ridiculous thing that we've allowed to happen. And I know BEFRA are trying to deal with that. with new ear tags to put in cows' ears, so they will be restricted to the holding for the rest of the cow's life, as long as you want it to be, but you'll not be allowed to trade them live to somebody else. That's a no-brainer, surely, isn't it?
Yeah.
That is something that should have happened a long time ago.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's culpability on both sides, but there's plenty to do. And that, to me, it's not looking at how we got here. It's looking at what do we do next? And if we don't like the situation, what can we do to make it better? And there's plenty, actually. We've just got to agree to get on and do it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Mr. Gove has come in and sort of made all the right noises in his first few days, didn't he? He said he was going to listen to the science, and then he's kind of backtracked a little bit since then, hasn't he? So, I mean, do you have much hope that the government will grasp the nettle in the next 4 or 5 years or not?
I guess it depends on the results that we get from the existing tools. We've got to wait sufficient length of time, as the RBCT did, to report on those. You're not going to get the results in year one. But by year six, you'd probably have a reasonable feel for what impact that strategy has had. But a man who, I'm quite enthusiastic that Mr. Gove has got the job. It doesn't help if you say you're going to listen to experts, having just made a big campaign saying, well, we've had enough of experts. At the end of the day, it's a political decision. And it won't be based on expert evidence. It will be based on a range of facts, what he thinks is politically the best route.
Yeah.
And that doesn't necessarily have to fit with the facts at all.
No.
I hope it does. And the facts for me are quite evident. 2 years after the end of culling in the RBCT, TB had dropped by 50%. Well, that's a damn good result.
Yeah.
So, yeah, if we do the cull efficiently, effectively, then hopefully we get better results, because we're trying to do more and be more effective than the RBCT was.
Mm. Mm. Well, it's an awful thing. I mean, I know in this area, I mean, a very good friend of mine has had problems. He lost a load of cows couple of months ago, and I mean, the human side of it as well as the animal side is, I think, something a lot of people won't realize, because the stress, as you say, if you've got a closed herd and in the relationship you have with your cows, and you've built them up over a long time, over many generations, and it's an awful thing when you lose them like that, isn't it?
Well, it's on so many levels, because you've got the, if you like, when foot and mouth came to town, the last time it did, our neighbours went down with foot and mouth. Defra rang me up and said, right, we're going to kill all your cows, Mr. Latham, on the contiguous cow policy. On the contiguous coal policy, Lord Krebs' idea. And but you had to give permission for your cows to go. It wasn't by, if you like, government decree. Because they don't have the disease, you still had to give your permission. And I refused. And at the time, we had 850 cows and all the young stock that go with it, and a few beef calves. And when I had my valuation done, we could have had $2,500 a cow. But I walked round on the night before it was due to happen, and you think, everything I've worked for, everything, the last 20 years, all those decisions I've made, and you're wandering around at night knowing full well, checking for bullers, looking for carvers, then tomorrow everything's dead. And you say to yourself, if I don't say no tomorrow, it's all gone, and I've got to start again, and I don't know the animals, and it's not my, these are my cows. And so I said, no, you can't have them, you're not having them. And it's not just a simple financial transaction, because we would have made a reasonable check in the hands. The math's pretty straightforward, but it's not just about the money, and it's not just about it's about, if you like, you know, I guess you're the, yeah, it's the wrong analogy. You're like a shepherd, aren't you? They're my animals, and I want to look after them and to the very best of my ability.
Yeah.
But at the same time, with TB, you've then got, as we had, a fifth of your turnovers disappeared. You've then got no access to sell your calves to the market. And how long will that go on for? And you don't know whether to rear your calves to hopefully get a reasonable value at the end, because while you're under restriction, you've got reduced market access. Everybody knows that, so they rob you, and the prices are rubbish. So it's just the market working, but you're severely disadvantaged if you can sell your animals to a finishing unit, or we certainly were. And then you've got an uninsurable risk that we had a limited amount of insurance for our outbreak, but we can't get insurance again. So with the compensation money that you get, which in our case was only about 70% of the values of the animals when we had them valued, because we had a policy which meant we had to go through an individual valuation for every animal. So, you know, I can give you the numbers on that. I'm sorry, I completely just lost my thread for a second. So when we did that, you get your money. Mm. Why would you reinvest it back into your dairy farm? If you went to a set of investors and said, I'll tell you what, I've got this money, I've got $100,000 in my back pocket, would you come and put it into a dairy farm where the rewards of return on investment is not so good, it's incredibly volatile, and now we've got an unmanageable disease in the area for which I can't create a structure in the business which allows me to exist with it. If you could tell that to Dragon's Den, they just go, I'm out. It would be a millisecond before Duncan Bannatyne would have gone out. You know, that would have been it. And that's the position you're in. So you're trapped. You've got all your borrowings to service. You've got a reduced income. You don't know how long it's going to last. And you're not in control. And that, with the emotional side, the impact on the family and the staff, and you're losing the animals that you like at the wrong stage in their life. It's a horrendous thing. I remember on the back of our situation, we made a decision that, you know, we first made a decision, right, we're out. And then once we get clear, and then looking at the business more objectively, cold light of day, it's easy to say those things, but you think, oh, crikey, what's going to pay the bills?
Yeah.
If we pack up, it's a tenant dairy farm. If it's not the dairy farm, we'd probably lose the FBT land. Then you've got half of the farm that you had. And then you've still got all that infrastructure, you've still got all those borrowings, you've got to find a new business model, but it's a dairy farm. Yeah. It's not an arable farm. Yeah, and you're stuck. So you're on a treadmill, and we made the decision, obviously, to get stuck in again and get going again. But yeah, it's a kind of a 3-year grieving cycle to get through that one episode of TB.
Yeah.
People should not underestimate the massive pressures that puts on certainly the key decision makers. I remember when we got told we were clear, it was a guttural, emotional feeling of relief, you know, and almost I had to sit down on the floor, almost collapse with relief. It was incredible, actually. But, you know, I think when people from the outside the industry look at what we're doing, well, you're going to kill your cows anyway. They're only there to earn your money. You don't care about them. God, that stings when you hear it, but that's genuinely what some people believe.
It is.
And they don't understand the relationship
on social media, don't you?
Between you do, and they don't understand that relationship. So
no.
I spend a lot of time on social media trying to chip away at that, not in an aggressive way, I hope, but in a reasonably polite way to try and make sure that people understand that isn't actually how we see it.
Mm. And do you think you make any progress with that?
Well, Brian May got in touch and asked me to go to his TB symposium.
Yeah.
We had I was invited to see the speakers, and he came over to make a fuss afterwards in a nice way to say thanks for coming. And I think we'll get nowhere if we stick at the sort of polar opposites. We have to find an agreed path and bring people with us. I don't agree that when we've done the cull, that we haven't done TB testing of the badgers that we've culled in order to prove that there's a need. For me, it's a ridiculous situation because if there was no TB in those badges, we're wasting our time.
Mm.
If there's plenty of TB in those badges, it justifies what we're doing. Unfortunately, for the audience that we're talking to, I don't think it makes any difference to the people who are opposing it. If 100% of badges had TB, they still wouldn't want to cull.
Yeah.
So they're not. While it's a ridiculous situation that we can't prove our point, it wouldn't necessarily make any difference to the people who you're trying to make a point to because they believe that badgers are innocent and shouldn't be culled anyway.
Mm.
But I think it's important that we have that dialogue.
Yeah. Well, if we just stick two fingers up, it's just going to make the situation worse, isn't it? We've got to try and you've always got to try and look at it from the other side's point of view, haven't you? And I think it's there, it's not going away, and we've got to try and do something.
Yeah, that it's dirty farmers or bad practice, or there is an element of bad practice. There are criminals in society. It doesn't make us all criminals. Mm. There are daft farmers who make some daft decisions, and that doesn't make us all daft. But you cannot pin this, the inexorable spread of TB over the last 25 years onto the malpractice of a tiny percentage of farmers. It would just, that's just not standing up to scrutiny. What the home range maps show of the spalliga, different TB spalliga types, is just a gradual increase in those areas. And TB is, very regional in terms of the type of strains, and those strains are not homogenized all over the country. And so that regional identity of TB wouldn't exist if it was just down to farmers moving animals around willy-nilly, because by now we'd have mixed it all up and there would just be one homogenous mix of TB. That is not what the science shows.
Okay, well, from the notes you sent me before the interview, it was part of the result of you deciding with a foot and mouth, you reduce your herd a bit, and you decided to diversify in a bit of a different direction. Can you tell us a bit about that, please, Phil?
Yeah, we've had a bit of a war with the Forestry Commission because we have a lot of boundary with the Forestry Commission.
Yeah.
And the rabbits in the forest would perpetually eat off the margins of all our crops. And with my reticence to want to kill things, I don't hunt, I don't shoot, I don't fish, apart from the odd mackerel. It's not really my thing, killing things. So gassing rabbits and things like that, not really my thing, and I don't really want to do it. We were trying to do it for a period to get on top of the rabbit population because the crop loss was quite pronounced. So we'd had a bit of a thing with the Forestry Commission. In the end, the compromise was that if they gave us the materials for a rabbit-proof fence, we would erect it. And so we decided on the boundary of the farm, which was about a mile and a half or more with the forest, we would put up a rabbit-proof fence. But the edge of the farm is quite slopey, so we think, well, I can't put the fence actually on the boundary. It's just not going to work. So we'll have to put the fence a little ways out. And, well, what are we going to do with the ground behind the fence? We've got to be able to top it or something. And you think, well, hang on a second. So we're going to need at least 4 meters wide, probably 8 meters wide of a grass strip. Oh, right, what the hell are we going to do with the grass strip? Well, I know, we'll have a farm ride. My father had been lucky enough to, when he sold the farm, he'd lent some money to the local sports association and set up a bowling green and tennis courts. And he then organised a farm ride across the sort of local community at Chumney and Chorley to pay himself back, amongst others. So we knew that with those charity rides, there was a population of frustrated riders out there with little access to land. And so
Cheshire's a very equestrian county, isn't it? There's a lot of horses in Cheshire.
It is. One of the numbers I've seen, I'm not sure how right it is, because they don't have the BCMS like we have for cattle in the horse world. But, one of the recent development organisations not so long ago was quoting the figure of 40,000 horses in Cheshire.
Yeah.
And if we could just have a few of them every day come and use a farm ride, that would be marvellous. So we started off with a grass track, and we're just going on a sort of one track's not much fun. So we'll make a sort of a route. And we started with a farm ride, and then that seemed to go okay. And then we started doing British Eventing affiliated horse trials a couple of times a year, and things have grown. So, just bit by bit, we've been adding to the sort of portfolio of facilities and events. So we had to, we've been nudging away at the equestrian side. And then with the buildings, I'm lucky, I've got three cousins. They're three business-minded cousins. They all have their own businesses, and they all sell furniture. So one sells antique furniture, one sells beds, one sells a more modern type of furniture, pressed oak type furniture.
Okay.
And a whole range of stuff. And so they rent my sheds off me, essentially.
Okay. So what's I had a look at the website kelsallhill.co.uk. It's hugely impressive. I'm not really a big horse person, so I don't really know much about it. But I mean, to me, it looks, you offer a really wide range of stuff there. I mean, you've got all kinds of events going on, and you seem to have grown very quickly, really, to where you are now.
I guess it's all about, I guess it comes from my dad, I suppose. But both of us, we've driven to, if you're going to do something, let's try and do it well. And that's all it is. So, you know, if we, whatever we're doing, we're trying. And, you know, we're really lucky with the British eventing, with the team that we've got within our own team. It's excellent. And we've got Captain Mark Phillips as our cross-country course designer. We can't get any higher than that. He's an Olympic gold medalist. He was the American Olympic team coach. And, you know, he's sought after at a lot of very big events to be their course designer. And we're extremely privileged to have him help us. And he designs a really good course that the competitors like. And he works for the course builder who's actually going to build the cross-country at the next Olympics. And he did Beijing Olympics. I think he did Sydney. And he does, you know, a lot of the big major events in the country. Even the lady who does the flower dressing at the events did London 2012. So we've got a really, they're a high caliber team of people that we've got working with us. And we've put a lot of effort in ourselves within our own team to try and turn something out that looks like a mini badminton. And it's, you know, there's a thrill, is it? It's a, I don't ride, you know, they make no sense about it. I don't want to ride. Scoop plenty of people up who have a bad experience with gravity. And, you know, it's just not, that is not my thing. But I think as farmers, we understand ground care. We understand grass. We understand practical stuff. And to turn an event out, that's what we're about. It's not how we ride it. I don't feel that I have any ability to comment on people's riding abilities at all. It's not where I need to be.
No.
But, you know, as long as they come and it looks like a nice grass green carpet and it's all smooth and lovely and looks mown and tidy, then I've done my job.
Yeah. And do you enjoy dealing with the public and people coming and going onto the farm? And do you enjoy the whole aspect of it?
I love it, actually. And I think the reason that is when you're selling milk, there really is very little feedback about how good a good job you're doing. There's no feedback from your customer because you don't really know your customer. Your customer is your milk purchaser, and it's an odd relationship that we have. The contractual structure and everything is weird. But when you're selling haylage, and you know, we have a portfolio of different products, I suppose. We sell hay, high fiber grass, we sell Italian ryegrass, perennial ryegrass, all bagged up into different size bags. So there may be large haylage bales, there may be what we call medium bales or 20 kilo briquettes that we can turn them into, and nice branded bags and everything. When you're delivering them, you get an immediate feedback. If they don't like it, they tell you straight away. You know, if they do like it, it's wonderful because they'll tell you you've done a good job. So I like the feedback we get from British eventing. If we started to do a less diligent job and less attention to detail and we didn't get the feedback, I would be very upset. It drives me to want to do it and carry on doing it. And I like the immediacy of it and the fact that we can, I think there's a monkey on my back, I suppose. I hate the fact that as farmers, we're labeled, we're stereotyped, and we are thought of as sort of straw chewing hillbillies. It's absolute nonsense. We're really entrepreneurial people trying to survive in a real market with very slim pickings. And so it's given me a chance to go, actually, it's quite life affirming that you get a nice reaction. We're all right. We're doing a good job. You know, people tell us we're doing a good job. It's a wonderful thing.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, that's kind of what I'm trying to show off with this podcast, really. I get frustrated with the stereotypes too, and I'm trying to show off the different array of characters and as you say, entrepreneurs that are in it. And it's nice when people tell me that they've enjoyed it and they didn't realise this or they didn't know that. And I think that you're right. It's always good to hear. So what's one of the main reasons I wanted to have you on tonight, Phil, was Len's leg. Can you tell us what that is, please? What is it and how did it come about?
Len's leg is hashtag Len's leg is a social media campaign to try and create a bit more awareness of health and safety in the agricultural community. And it came about because there have been a number of high-profile farm deaths and a number of farm deaths reported this year, and we were having a bit of a conversation on Twitter about it, and one of the positions taken was, well, you know, as an industry we need to do better, and we do need to do better. The statistics are shocking. I think one person dies something like every 13 days in because of an agricultural accident. And that's pretty terrible. And there's no doubt that we do need to do better. But what does it mean to say you need to do better? It means very little. It's just a nice thing to say.
Yeah.
So we were having a bit of a Twitter argument about it. And for me, you know, we're stuck with long hours, slim margins, long days, unpredictable cattle, heavy loads, lots of kit, lots of people.
Yeah.
And it's inevitable that there will be some accidents. So having taken that position, I was kind of a bit castigated. I wasn't taking it all very seriously. But I do take it seriously. I take it very seriously. And we've got a big health and safety plan and all the rest of it, all drawn up with the lads. But to diffuse the sort of heightening tension, I said, well, I do take it seriously because my grandfather lost a leg in a farm accident. And in 1931, he was moving out of the farm at Brookhouse to go and set his own tenancy up on Chumley Estate. And as they were moving some of the kit with a trailer and a shire horse, he got his foot stood on and the horseshoe crushed his foot a bit, and he got an infection in his foot, and he ended up losing his leg with gangrene. Now, I've no idea what the protocol is for a prosthetic limb. My granddad died, I think, when I was about 7, but granddad's leg's still in the house because it is, and I guess it will stay there for a long time because it seems terribly disrespectful to throw it out.
Yeah.
So I said, well, granddad's leg's still in the thing, and I understand the problem. And John Charles Jones, oh, I bet you wouldn't bring that to the NFU National Council to highlight health and safety. Right, okay. He said, I'll give you 20 quid for the air ambulance or Rabbi if you do. It's fair enough. So at the last National Council meeting, there was an agenda item from the Midlands talking about putting a stop button on the back of tractors. And as a resolution, they'd come up with the idea that that got NFU backing, would help in the case of people mucking around the back of a tractor. Something goes wrong, you can immediately kill the engine. Would probably be a useful thing.
Yeah.
And to support the resolution, I'd taken the leg along and I put the leg on the table and said, you know, this leg should stand for something, you know, which, again, tried to diffuse with a bit of black humour the seriousness of the situation, because there have been a lot of farm deaths. And when I was growing up, I looked at my neighbours, and of my neighbours, there were 8 neighbouring farms. One chap fell through a roof, broke his neck and died. Another chap was doing his gutters, fell off a ladder and was paralysed from the waist chest down. And there's a son-in-law of another neighbour who fell through a roof and damaged his back. And they thought for a while that he would be in trouble, but he fully recovered. But of the 2 farms where the guys had, you know, serious, terrible outcomes, those farms have gone now. And, you know, you look around your neighbours and you think, I have a herdsman who was working for me, went to work for another local farmer who lost, put his hand in a straw blower and got a rap on the knuckles. It was cold. He was wearing big leather gloves. When he pulled his arm out and took the glove off, all his fingers stayed inside the glove. Now they put them all back on, but what on earth was going through his head when that happened? And if you look around your neighbours, there's a chap in the local community with one arm because he lost it in a PTO accident. I was talking to a farmer yesterday who's fallen off his haystack. His leg's now bolted together. You know, the endless number of people who've got fingers that have been nipped in drive belts for things. The things that, you know, my cousin last year got crushed by his ball, cracked 7 ribs, got 2 burst lungs. You know, we've almost become sensitized to it or desensitized to it. And we accept that this is a roughy, toughy industry, almost the badge of honor. And when you know, if that leg could do anything, it would have given us a kick up the backside, actually, to start reassessing the way we work, because there's more to life than executing the plan today. And sometimes that becomes the big deal, doesn't it? We've got to get on, we've got to do it. And people do stupid things. So having said my piece at council, and John Charles Jones said his piece, and then Stuart Roberts had listened to it and then got in touch with us a couple of days later and said, look, I've come up with this idea of a challenge. And the challenge is, we'll go call it Len's Leg, hashtag Len's Leg, and can you make 30 health and safety improvements in 30 days? And I think it's a really good idea, because it's dead easy to do something on the first day one. and then you keep progressing. And some of these things are really small. You know, yesterday we've laminated a poem about health and safety and put it on the office wall and give everybody a copy. It's designed to sort of prick people's consciences. There are some daft things, you know, bits of PPE that are missing. There's, we've got goggles for handling hyperchlorite, but no gloves. You know, why haven't we got gloves? Well, someone's misplaced them and they've never been replaced. There's PTO guards. There's lots of little things when you look at your farm that you can say, do you know what, for very little money, I could improve that.
Yeah.
And, you know, let's emphasize the fact that we're going to have a safe practice. We're going to put the handbrake on when we get off things. The handbrakes have all got to work.
Yeah.
You know, the things that we, you know, how many times have people parked a tractor in a particular way because the handbrake's not working, either put your scraper down or turn the wheels up a hill? And, you know, we've all been there. We've all done it.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous. And, but I think the chronic nature of the challenge, actually, the fact it's going to last 30 days, means that by day 30, you should have everybody mentally in a slightly different place.
Mm.
And there's plenty of chat between different farmers sharing ideas and just trying to create a culture of actually identifying risks and addressing them in, you know, straightforward economic ways. And if they're, you know, things that need addressing because there's a legal requirement, they've got to be addressed, haven't they? You know, PTO guards and things like that have to be done. We've got complacent. And I think the statistics this week show that farming as an industry is 18 times worse than any other.
I read that, yeah.
And that is why. And it is because we are, I guess, mainly a lot of people self-employed, taking their own risks, working long hours. The financial incentive to take shortcuts is there because the margins are so slim, that people are doing two jobs and paying themselves the income effectively for one and looking to economize on things. And then there's that relentless pressure of, if you like, trying to squeeze as much out of the day to get an economic reward when, you know, when the prices are low. So, you know, it's the long hours culture that we've got ourselves in has come about, I suppose, because we've accepted that as a route to profit. And and I think, you know, there's got to be a new balance struck to try and improve on things. You know, I met two representatives of CAT today, and my challenge to them was, it's all very well buying a machine from them and getting the delivery instructions, but where do you find your training for your staff? Not for operating. We can do that. Our guys have got tickets. But for the maintenance, you know, when we were moving haylage last week, JCB came over from the other farm, and quite truthful, it was overheating. And so we lifted the side up on the JCB, and you're looking in at the engine, and everyone's like, what do we do now? And we start trying to faith heal it, like putting our hands on things. And we don't know why we're touching things, but we're touching things.
Yeah.
And some of those things are next to things that are moving really quickly, and some other bits of it are really bloody hot.
Yeah.
At the same time, I'm looking in going, look, lads, you've been milling wheat and there's oily wheat all in the engine tray here. So why on earth have we got that? My hand's in there, I'm scooping out oily wheat. It turns out the aircon pump's rolling around on the engine tray that's sheared off its bracket. We don't even know what it is. We can't even identify it between us because my level on machinery is Lego. And I don't know how to educate the staff because I don't have the skills. Where do I find that? So I said to Kat, you know, could you not develop some kind of training offer for the agricultural community so that, you know, when you've got your staff and if your staff have changed and or you've inherited a new machine, you can send them off to CAT at Winsford or wherever and for a half day's training course on the routine maintenance of CAT kit. Why not? You know, because I don't know how to find that training to upskill them if it doesn't come from the manufacturer. It's not coming for, I was at Rees Heath last week and I talked to the principal and they have a tie up with JCB and they're doing training on engine maintenance for their own technicians for JCB and the students are using the kit. But at the moment, there's no training offer for JCB kit to the local agricultural community. And yet there's quite a lot of JCB kit in the local community.
Yeah.
It seems to me a pretty straightforward market opportunity for them to offer a training course, and it would be great for us as farmers to be able to source that kind of training, but at the moment it doesn't exist. And I guess the tractor driver I grew up with on the farm was a chap named called Jack, and Jack worked for my granddad, he worked for my dad, and he worked the best part of 20 years with me, and so he'd done 50 years on the farm before he retired. And Jack was the tractor driver. So Jack, go and plough, please can you go and fertilise, whatever it is that we needed to do. Jack did it, but I became incredibly lazy because I didn't need to do it. Mm. So I just don't have that, you know, I'm an animal man, I'm not a kit man. And but I do appreciate the fact that we need to, if you like, hit a minimum legal standard, but we need to go beyond that by encouraging everybody to get more knowledge so that when we've got bits of kit, we can maintain it to stop it going wrong so often, and that they don't then hurt themselves trying to fix things in an inappropriate way with the adrenaline of the, you know, in the face of an accident. You know what it's like, something goes wrong, there are bits of metal flying everywhere. The first thing you want to do is touch stuff and put it back. And it's, you know, you need a count to five policy almost, where you just let everything stop and slow down, 5 seconds to gather your thoughts before you dive in and do something.
Sometimes it is just about stepping back and looking with a fresh eye, isn't it? You know, you can rush past something every day and not notice it as a safety risk until you take a minute after a campaign like this and look at it with a bit of a fresh eye, and you think, oh Christ, you know, those wheels aren't tied up, or you know, as you say, there's no goggles there, or you don't even notice it in your rush to just get the jobs done every day.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's a culture we've got ourselves in. Mm. And we like it because it's tough, and we like to think we're tough. But our partners and friends and the people that we're responsible to, you know, it's a different, you know, it shouldn't be that you're going out and worried that, you know, partners shouldn't be worried that you're not going to come back. You know, that shouldn't be how it is.
No. I mean, the industry, I followed a tractor on the road last week, and a neighbour of mine, I won't mention any names, but the tractor, I wouldn't have driven it in the field, let alone on the road. Didn't have any indicators. There was shit all over the back window. The mirrors were broken. You know, and it's not uncommon, is it, to see that kind of thing? You know, I think the industry, you're right, we do have to take a bit more of a collective responsibility, don't we?
You know, construction have had that problem, and I think largely pushed by clients probably have addressed it because of the client's demands to improve it. The trouble is, we've got our one customer doesn't come on and inspect health and safety. But if we want less farm deaths and we want a safer environment, we have to decide what we're going to do differently in order to create a different result. It can't be that we just go, oh yeah, and we're aware of it when we're reading the tragic story that's of this week, and we forget about it until we read the tragic story next week. But that's not going to change anything.
No.
So I think, you know, I think Stuart's idea is commendable, and yeah, you know, we've been trying to do our bit to highlight the simple things that we can do to change in our own farm. And I think it's important. You know, I'm not trying to preach as some sort of health and safety angel. No. We've got our own issues. We've had daft things, you know. I think it's incredibly important that we do our damnedest not to have that dreadful conversation here. Unfortunately, when we were milking the cows at Organsdale, Chapa did have a heart attack in the milking parlour, and that was, you know, a massive heart attack, and died in my arms after 25 minutes of CPR and the rest of it. And it's a bloody horrendous experience. You know, you don't, you know. Yeah. I'm not sure we can avoid heart attacks, but we can avoid an awful lot of the risks that we take.
Absolutely.
And there's plenty of times where you go, I know no one's looking, I'll just have a go, or I'll just do that while no one's about. And really, is it worth it? It's not. Get a contractor. We have a zero tolerance for going on roofs. We have if you go on a roof, you're fired policy. Mm. I'm very explicit about it. And it's clearly because it's driven by the appalling statistics of my neighbours and what happened to them. But, you know, there are plenty of contractors who've got a sphere of competence who can do that. And I'm sure there are other things I can do rather than risk it all just to get the leaf out of the gutter.
Absolutely. Well, and for anyone listening, just do check out the hashtag LensLeg on Twitter if you're on there, because there's some good stuff being posted and a lot of people taking notice, I think. So, commend you and everyone else involved for starting it, because you know, it could, it could literally save someone's life. So, Phil, probably taken up enough of your time, and tonight's flown by. So what I usually do is, I want to ask you a bit about all your adventures from for all your whitewater rafting and scuba diving and all that, but we've kind of run out of time a little bit. But I ask five quick questions at the end of each interview, so if you're up for that, I'll fire away. So what's your all time favourite song?
I would think probably Elton John's Your Song, I would say.
Yeah, very good choice. And I know you're quite well travelled, as I mentioned there, with all your adventures. What's you've been all around the world. Where's the best place you've been? Where's your favourite place?
Gosh, I guess it's a really tricky question because there's so many aspects, isn't there? And, you know, yeah. Best in what way? I suppose as a mad keen scuba diver, the best place for me would be the Maldives.
Okay. If you could have a superpower, what would it be? To be in more than one place at once, I would imagine.
If you could have a superpower, what would it be? It just depends how cheeky or cheesy I want to be, isn't it, really? I don't know. I don't know how cheesy to be. It just sound. I guess the superpower you'd like most is to make people happy, wouldn't it? Wouldn't that be a power?
It would. And on a slightly different tack, because you're from Cheshire and from Nantwich as well, what's your favourite cheese?
Stilton.
Okay, good choice.
You can't beat it.
With a drop of port.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
And lastly, if you had to recommend a farmer or someone involved with agriculture to follow on social media to a non-farmer, who would it be and why?
I would suggest James Robinson.
Yeah.
I think he's an exemplary ambassador for the dairy industry.
Absolutely agree. He's a great guy, is James. Yeah, I agree. Very good answer. So, thanks so much for talking to us tonight, Phil. I really appreciate you taking the time, as I know you're obviously
an
incredibly busy guy. And keep up the good work, and best of luck with everything for the future.
Thank you very much. Thanks for asking.
And to everyone at home, thanks for listening, for the ongoing support and nice comments. Hugely appreciated, as always. You can find the podcast from my Twitter page at Will Penry Evans, Stitcher app or iTunes. And if you've got a minute and you're enjoying these, please could you leave me a positive review on iTunes to help grow the podcast. It's a really big help if you do that. Thanks again. I've been Will Evans. This has been Rock and Roll Farming. Thank you and good night.